So this session is called Secrets for Winning at Work, the Handbook for Emerging Professionals and Career Success. I'm Brenda Dennis. I'm with Cisco Systems. We're one of the sponsors of the conference this year. And we're really proud to be here to support the efforts of the Texas Conference as well as just the advancement of women overall. I've been with Cisco for about 18 years now. And when I started, we had about 5,000 employees. We now have 75,000. And I'm pleased to say that I'm now not one of about five women in the company. There's many more. So we're working very hard on making sure we get a very inclusive and collaborative work environment. I also lead our Cisco Women Executive Network. I'm one of the sponsors for that, where we have many different leadership initiatives for women in Cisco. So for those of you who don't know Cisco, we are a networking company, and we power much of the Internet. So you think about the Internet that you touch every day is Cisco equipment in there. Collaboration, whenever you watch TV, you're checking your email, you're looking at your smartphone, a lot of that is empowered by Cisco. So we need more women and girls in the technology space. We need more women and girls in STEM, and we're thrilled to be part of this program to help get more women considering technology as an avenue for them and also just helping women all overall. So for many of you that have started into the workforce in the last few years, it's not an easy thing to do to get in and quickly maneuver your way through different organizations. So for the first time in history, we have four different generations in our workforce. We have the traditionalists, the boomers, the Gen X, and the Gen Y, and it's creating some interesting and unique challenges and opportunities for all of those different generations, and we're going to talk about that today. So we're going to discuss how young people coming into our organizations can sort of chart their career success and chart their career path, and we're going to talk about some career action plans, some things you can walk away to use in your journeys as you get back into your work. So we've got two amazing speakers for you today. I'm really excited to have the opportunity to introduce them to you. So first, we're going to hear from Jessica Bacall. Jessica directs the Wirtle Center for Work and Life at Smith College, which is an independent women's college in Massachusetts. Her center's program teaches students critical leadership skills, life skills, stress reduction, and reflection. She is an author. Her first book was Mistakes I Made at Work, 25 Influential Women Reflect on What They Got Out of Getting It Wrong. And what I love about that is it's about let's be vulnerable. We all aren't doing everything perfectly, so let's learn from those mistakes and move on. So we'd like to welcome Jessica. She'll be up in just a moment. We're also joined today by Kate White, who is an internationally known expert on leadership and success. She's a New York Times bestselling author of several influential books on work and careers, including I Shouldn't Be Telling You This, How to Ask for Money, Snag the Promotion, and Create the Career You Deserve. Love the title. Love the book. So for 14 years, Kate has been the editor-in-chief of Cosmopolitan, which was the best-selling monthly magazine during her tenure and was published in 64 different countries. So welcome, Kate. So we're thrilled to have you both here, and we look forward to learning from both of you. So why don't we go ahead and start off with Jessica? I'd like to welcome you up to the stage. Thanks.
Thank you. I'm so honored to be here and to be sharing this program with Kate White. Her book is fabulous. I haven't used this clicker yet, so we'll see if it works. I think it does. So I'm just going to tell you a little bit of the story about how I came to write my book on mistakes. And I'll talk about kind of three important takeaways that I think are useful for people in actually any generation. There are three important lessons that I learned. And the genesis of the book actually also relates to my kind of connection with Gen Y at Smith. So I direct the Wirtle Center for Work and Life at Smith College in Northampton, Mass. And this is what it looks like right now. It's fall. It's really beautiful. Let's see. What do I have to point this at to have it? Point it at that. No. I'll just advance the slide. Okay. So this is what it looks like now. So if you're thinking about going to college or you have there are young women you know who are getting ready to go to college, think about Smith. It's all women. It is. We have students from every state and from 60 countries around the world, and have the only all-women's engineering program. And I really love it. And I actually didn't go to a women's college, but I've being in an all-women's environment is pretty incredible. At working in a, there's men there who teach there too, and in the graduate programs. But it's working. Oh, great. Okay. But I just think it's really special, and I think it's some of the that feeling is some of the reason why people come to conferences like this, frankly. Here's another picture. I was looking online at our pictures on our college website, and I couldn't resist throwing in a few others. That's our campus center. Really beautiful. So some things that I do in the Wordle Center is kind of try to develop non-traditional leadership workshops. This is one we did recently. It was powerful movement through African dance. So there I am. You can see me kind of looking, feeling a little silly. Doing African dance, but it was something that we did, you know, to kind of encourage people to put themselves out there and take physical risks and take up space with their bodies, which is important for women. And here are Smith College faculty working with students. So I'm not a faculty member, and my background is not in higher ed. So when I first got to Smith, which was about 8 years ago, I felt really intimidated. And the mistake, I'm going to start off by telling you about one of my own mistakes. And it really relates to kind of the intimidation I felt being at this really prestigious college, but not being faculty. So my boss wanted to she had a proposal to develop a concentration in leadership, actually. And she asked me to go and sit with faculty members and tell them about this proposal and hand it out. And I felt nervous. Every time I was around faculty, I would feel this like anxiety and like I'm not being articulate enough. And the time came for when I was supposed to sit down with these people and present this proposal. And I got a call from my daughter's school saying she was sick. She was about less than a year at that time. So here was kind of the pull of maternal feelings. I wanted to go pick her up. But then a little part of me also felt like, oh, here's a chance to get out of this meeting. So I turned to my assistant, Allie, and I said, would you be willing to just go to the meeting and take notes and hear the proposals? You know, you can just give them to people and, you know, just be a presence. I went and got my daughter, and the next day I came in. My daughter was fine after a day or so. I came in and I asked Allie, how did it go? You know, hoping everything had just been fine. And she said, actually, you know, they had a lot of questions, and I couldn't really answer them. And I thought, okay, you know, I hadn't really expected her to answer the questions because she'd just graduated from college herself. But I kind of just hoped nothing else would come of this, and I lay low. Then I was in my boss's office for a regular meeting, and she said, you know, I heard you sent Allie to this meeting with faculty to deliver my proposal. That was really bad judgment. What were you thinking? And I didn't say, well, I was thinking that I wouldn't have to do it. but I said, you know, you're right. It was bad judgment. And she said, you know, that was a really, they had a lot of questions and misgivings. It was a bad way to get, you know, started with this. I'm just going to take it off the table altogether. So I felt terrible about this. It was something that had been seemed important to my boss. Luckily, over the years, I earned her trust again, and we still have a very close relationship. We're still working together, even though she retired. And I also became more comfortable giving presentations. But you know, it'd be nice if I could tell you, well, that was my one mistake, and I didn't make any others. That's not the case. So, you know, I felt a lot of anxiety all the time about doing things right. And, you know, it wasn't just me who was feeling this way. Students at Smith talked about wanting to do everything right. They talked about getting to their first year and going into classes and feeling like they didn't want to raise their hands because what if what they said wasn't as articulate as something someone else said? or not wanting to go in and meet with professors. And it wasn't, there was research that I was starting to see about young women at other colleges. So Duke did this study that's now known as the Effortless Perfection Study. So young women there felt this mandate to, you know, be doing everything perfectly but not seem like you were trying at all. Effortless perfection. At Princeton, there was a study about women feeling very anxious about taking on leadership roles where they'd be in the spotlight, because what if they screwed up? I read this quote. It was in Forbes.com. This was a Barnard senior, another women's college, who wrote, "Young women today are bred to doubt ourselves, question our worth, and view ourselves as improvable projects rather than embrace the imperfection of our humanity." And she said she thought this was really getting in the way of young women putting themselves out there as leaders. And this piece she wrote was shared something like 80,000 times and got 10,000 likes on Facebook. So clearly it resonated with people. And I really agreed with her, because the more I was learning at Smith, running this leadership center, kind of seeing what's out there in terms of research on success and leadership, I was coming to see that people who knew about this stuff knew that you had to take risks and make mistakes. So Daniel Goleman, who is a psychologist and a journalist, talked about great leaders having a thirst for constructive criticism. Angela Duckworth, who's at University of Pennsylvania, also a psychologist, talks about grit as being a main ingredient for among successful people, and it's really the ability to persevere through errors and setbacks and low moments. And then there's this guy, Ron Heifetz, who's a leadership expert at Harvard. He writes about adaptive leadership and risk-taking. He actually makes his Harvard Business School students get up in class. The classes might be as big as this, and sing in front of everyone, just so they can have the experience of taking risks publicly and getting used to that feeling. So I knew that this, people who knew about success and leadership knew that mistakes were just a part of it. But I felt like this wasn't being modeled for women by women. I was going to leadership conferences like this one, and there was one where it was actually engineers, and these women all on the panel were asked, could you talk about a mistake that you made in your career? And what they basically said was, oh, yes, mistakes are so important. You learn more from your mistakes than you do from your successes. But they didn't share stories. And I think it's because it's hard to tell stories about mistakes we've made. I mean, it's kind of humiliating, and you're sitting there with other peers who you respect and, put on the spot. It's hard to come up with something that you feel comfortable sharing. But I was seeing this again and again. I was at there was another big event that was in Washington where there were these top leaders in government, and the same question was asked. It was actually the first question of the panel. Congresswoman Jane Harman asked, let's kick off by talking about a mistake. One woman who had been in the military said, we don't make mistakes. Another woman talked about having majored in the wrong thing in college. So I just thought, you know what? This needs to be out there. We need stories. The students need stories. I need stories to make myself feel better about mistakes at work. We need some narrative to model for each other that mistakes are part of a successful career. And kind of to, go against this perfectionism that I was seeing. So I got a book proposal together for this book, Mistakes I Made at Work, and there was a great agent who also had gone to a women's college, who's a feminist and was excited about the project, and she helped me sell the idea to a publisher, and then it was like, uh-oh, I have to do it. So I had 9 months to get it done and do these. I did interviews with influential women. And, after the book was finished, the mistakes are divided into four categories, as you'll see if you see it out there, if you come to the signing. But when I had to then go out and do my first talk recently about the book, I sat down and was thinking, well, okay, what did I really learn? Like, what did I myself get out of this? And there are three important lessons that I think I got out, and I'm going to share them with you through a few of the stories in the book. That's the book. The first story I want to tell is someone I interviewed. Her name is Rinku Sen. She's the director of an organization called Race Forward. It's a social justice organization. She told a few stories, and I'm going to tell a couple of them. One is about when she was 23 years old and co-director of the Center for Third World Organizing in New York. She had an intern who she hired who was younger than she was, and she thought everything was going along fine. She was assigning work to this intern. She was, the intern would bring the work back, and Rinku would comment on it, and then, you know, they worked together for several months, and then the internship was over. And when it was over, Rinku is South Asian. This woman was South Asian as well. When it was over, this young woman came to Rinku and said that she hadn't met her expectations as a South Asian woman mentor. And Rinku felt kind of horrible, but she just basically said, you know what, this doesn't have to do with me, it has to do with her. I mean, just in her mind, she kind of shut down and didn't really respond, and the conversation was quickly over. Over many years, though, she became someone who was really able to take in feedback, even difficult feedback like that. And she also talked to me about a time when she ran a workshop very recently, and her workshops are often very successful. But she ran a workshop where afterwards people gave feedback saying she was totally disconnected, she was cold, this was a terrible experience, she seemed like she didn't care. And this is what she does for a living. So she was pretty horrified, and her instinct was to immediately call up the person who'd hired her to run this racial justice workshop and kind of talk about what had happened and defend herself, but she didn't. Instead, she took some time, she called a friend and colleague and kind of went through what could have happened. Why did people come away with such a bad feeling after this particular workshop when normally people love her workshops? And she figured out that maybe she had been a little tired, maybe she had been distracted, and she figured out what she thought her next step should be. So she asked the people who'd hired her for more feedback. She ended up writing an email apologizing to the group and saying she took what they said into consideration. So she really used it as an opportunity to think about how in the future, if she felt that way, she would make sure she had some backup. She would make sure to bring someone with her to do the workshop so she wasn't going in alone to lead when she didn't quite feel up to it. And she gives this very good advice. We often think everything has to happen right now, especially when we're churned up emotionally, but it doesn't. And I think especially when for young people, like it's sometimes, you know, it can be really great to if you're getting feedback that feels hard to deal with, to say, you know, I think I need an hour to think about this, or a day, or I think I need a couple of days. And to be able to come back with, you know, to give yourself time to process and to be able to come back and have a calm conversation like she did. And so my takeaway really from her is that, you know, she really, over those years between when she was 23 and she's probably like 40 now, she developed self-awareness that you really need to take in criticism. And I think you need that self-awareness to self-regulate, to know that you feel like crap because of something someone just said. And then, you know, that self-regulation allows you to not react, take in criticism, you know, evaluate your performance, get some perspective, take the time you need. And I think that's an important lesson, you know, for Gen Y, for Gen X, really for anyone. Because, you know, you never stop feeling bad when people criticize you, but you do get a thicker skin over the years, I think. The next person I'm going to talk about, the next lesson comes from psychologist Carol Dweck. She was in graduate school at Yale in the 70s, And she really admired this guy named Seymour Saracen, who was a professor there. And one day she was sitting in her advisor's office, and the advisor said, you know, Seymour Saracen thinks you're really smart. She felt great. She felt so, she was like flying high. It was so validating to hear that this person she respected thought she was smart. But after that, she avoided Seymour Saracen completely. She never took a class with him. She never pursued research with him. And when she told me this story, she says that looking back, she feels like she really missed out on an opportunity, but that she was afraid that, you know, he had this idealized vision of who she was, and that if she showed who she really was, that might change, and she didn't want it to change. You know, what's interesting is that in the work she was doing at Yale and continued to do, she was looking at failure. And she says that I didn't realize this was me search. you know, it was really research that had to do with her own issues. So she was giving these fifth graders puzzles, and they would make the puzzles harder and harder. And some kids who got the hard puzzles would say, I can't do this. I'm not going to do this anymore, and put it away and not want to keep working. And other kids would say, oh, I love a challenge. This is great. And they would actually end up doing puzzles that were even beyond their ability because they were so into focusing and figuring out this tricky puzzle. She wondered, why is it so different? These kids weren't that different in ability, but some saw a challenge as really exciting, challenging puzzle, and some were like totally put off. And she realized that for these kids, ability itself had different meanings. Like some kids saw it as fixed, like you can't change your ability, and others saw it as changeable, that you could grow your ability. And it really affected how they actually did on these tasks. It's kind of crazy. It's been replicated all around the world. And through those initial studies and many subsequent studies, she developed this theory of growth mindset versus fixed mindset. So in a fixed mindset, you value looking smart over learning. And you think effort is bad because it means you're not smart. And you think failures define you. With a growth mindset, you value learning and effort, and you see mistakes and setbacks as tools for learning. So I think this is incredibly useful. My second big takeaway is that each of us should try to have a growth mindset at work and at home. And I'll just give two examples for me. I grew up in New York City, and I barely drove my whole growing up. And so when I moved to Massachusetts, I started to drive a little more. But then recently with the stuff happening with my book, I had to drive myself to Maine for a talk. And I just literally thought to myself, driving is something I can get better at. I can get better at driving. You know, it seems like such a silly thing. You think, like, how can she feel that way about driving? But, you know, I think we each have those things where it's like we might have total growth mindset in one area and a fixed mindset in the other, and there might not even be any logic to it. It might have to do with things people told us when we were little or, you know, things we've seen modeled. I think I've ended up really having a growth mindset at work because I've felt so anxious initially about meeting with professors, but then I gradually, you know, I kind of basically thought to myself, you know what, if I feel anxious, it means it's a learning opportunity. Like, this is good for me. And I just made myself go into those meetings, and I feel calmer these days at work. Not that I'm not still nervous sometimes, but overall I'm much more comfortable meeting with faculty. And my last takeaway has to do with something that I think really pervades almost every story in the book. It's about being brave. So this is Carla Harris. She's vice chairman of Global Wealth Management. She's at Morgan Stanley. She's one of the most powerful women on Wall Street. And in the book, she tells this amazing story of when it was very early in her Wall Street career, and there was some transaction she did where she was going on something that a peer had just done with his transaction, but hers was a really different kind of transaction. She didn't want to ask for help, and she ended up losing a lot of money. So she felt terrible about it, and she, you know, talked to her supervisor. She apologized for the mistake. There was this one guy on her floor who kept going around saying, "Can you believe it? We're still losing money on that transaction. Wow, that was a huge loss. I just can't believe how much money we're losing." And finally, she got tired of it. And she took this guy into a room privately. And she said to him, "I know you really want me to do well here. I know I made a mistake, and I feel really badly about it. It won't happen again. And I know I won't hear about this from you anymore, because I know you want to be supportive of me." And she didn't hear anymore. So I think it was incredibly collegial, actually, of her to like, figure out how to do it in that way, like couching it in that, "Oh, you're so supportive of me," when he was clearly being kind of an ass. But I think it was really brave also for her to confront him in that calm way and so directly. Someone else in the book is Cheryl Strayed, author of the books Torch and Wild and Tiny Beautiful Things. Wild is going to be about to come out as a movie with Reese Witherspoon playing Cheryl. And she just talks about sending out her work, her writing, and feeling terrified every time. And she wrote for this blog, this advice column, Dear Sugar, for a long time. It was very popular. Some of you may know it. And she just felt like with every blog advice column she sent out, it was going to be like, "Oh, this is the one where they're gonna figure out I don't know anything and I can't do this." And just that she said that terror of being a writer and sending your work into the world kind of doesn't end, even with great success. And now this is Anna Holmes, founding editor of Jezebel.com. She told me that when she was going to, when she agreed to start Jezebel, the blog Jezebel, she agreed to do it with a friend. And then at the last minute, the friend bailed and said that she was moving back to London. The Jezebel offices are in New York City. And Anna was going to do it herself. And she, you know, she says, "I wasn't thinking, oh, I'm about to do a really courageous thing." She was said, "You know, I am terrified." She was really scared. But she went ahead and did it. She wasn't going to quit. Then they'd have no one to run it. And she felt a little excited, too, because it was going to be her own thing. She talks more about that in the book. But I think what links all of these women is bravery. You know, they all were brave. And I think, you know, there are a lot of ways to be brave, and we don't always give ourselves, I think, enough credit for the ways in which we're brave at work. And for those of you who are in college, you know, for the ways we're brave at school. I think, you know, when you go and meet with a professor, I think that's really brave. You know, so there's a lot of, I think that it's important to recognize for ourselves and for each other when we're doing that. So those are my three takeaways. Cultivate self-awareness. Try to have a growth mindset. Be brave. And I'd love for you to connect with me by email, Twitter. There's my website. I don't know if I've taken my allotted time. I have. Okay, so I'm going to turn it over to Kate, and then Kate and I will answer questions.
That was great, Jessica. I want to start today with a little confession, just to, you know, get everything on the table. Yes, I'm the woman who used to write those crazy Cosmo cover lines, like, "Mattress moves so hot, his thighs will burst into flames." I just wanted to put that on the table, okay? But I'm not going to talk about any of that today. I'm not going to talk about men or love or sex. Well, the last time I said that, somebody went, "Damn." What I'm going to talk about today is success, and I'm going to offer three secrets of success I think every woman needs in the workplace. And because this talk today is really geared for emerging professionals, I'm going to offer some special caveats just for millennials. Now, first of all, what makes me such a big, fat expert on this? I've run 5 national magazines, including Cosmopolitan, as Brenda pointed out, for 14 years, where I took it to number 1 and kept it there. It's now number 3, but that's not my problem. Here's some of those cover lines. I used to tell my kids, oh, Mommy doesn't write those lines. We send the magazine to another place, and they write those lines there, okay? But a few years ago, I made the decision and told my boss that I wanted to wind down my time at Cosmo, focus on my career, my second career, writing suspense novels. I've written 10. The latest is Eyes on You. I'd love you to try one of those at some point. And I just wanted to be all in that realm of my life. And one of the things that happens when you get to a late stage in your career like I have, you get to look back and see things with a much sharper perspective and a clearer angle, and you have a sense of what worked and what didn't work. And I love to share what I learned with women younger than me. So here are the 3 secrets of success that I think are incredibly valuable and certainly helped me. The first is, you gotta go big or go home. Now, I know you've heard that expression, right? I first heard it from this young woman who worked with me at Cosmo. And when she said it, she was talking about Saturday night. And her point was, if you're gonna go out on a Saturday night and put in the time, you better be sure that your hair and your makeup and your clothes and your attitude are to the max. Because otherwise, why bother going? But when I heard that, I thought, you know what? There are applications to that phrase, beyond Saturday night. It's a fantastic mantra for work. Go big or go home. How many of you have heard of Helen Gurley Brown? She's the woman who in the 60s revolutionized Cosmopolitan magazine and made it a billion-dollar brand. I once heard her say that the difference between successful people and those who weren't was that the successful ones worked really, really hard. But you know what? I don't believe that. I think hard work is part of the equation. But when I look at my own success and that of the men and women I've known in New York, it always comes down to going big or going home. It's not enough to do what you've been told to do and do it really well. You have to step forward and raise your hand. You have to come up with big, bold, game-changing ideas, innovative ideas and solutions for your department and your company. Ideas that make your boss say wow and set you apart from the pack. Look, that's what Helen Gurley Brown did. She created a magazine that was so revolutionary at the time, that was candid and frank in a way no magazine had ever been for women. She actually did the first male centerfold. Burt Reynolds, the guy was so hairy, you can't tell where he ends and the bearskin rug begins, right? She knew all about going big or going home. About 16 years ago, this past August, I got a call from my boss. It was on a Sunday, and she wanted me to drive in and see her. And I was the editor-in-chief of Redbook then, and I said to my husband, whoa, something's up. I'm not the editor of Redbook anymore. And when I got there, to my shock, she told me, we want you to take over Cosmopolitan. I got home that night. I didn't even have a cell phone 16 years ago. And I said to my husband, you're not going to believe it. I'm the new editor of Cosmo. And he gets this look on his face, really kind of this silly grin. He goes, wait, I'm going to bed tonight with the editor of Cosmo? I think he thought they'd given me the Kama Sutra at the interview and said, learn every position in here, including the amazing Python, and learn them by Monday. But unlike him, I wasn't that wild about it. Cosmo wasn't on my radar. I hadn't been a big reader, and I was really nervous. But I took over the job, and I discovered I loved it. And as soon as I discovered I loved it, a couple months in, I thought, I've got to make it work. And I did it by always going big or going home. And this wasn't easy for me in my 20s. It was tough for me. I have, you know, good girl instincts as a nice Catholic girl. But I learned about going big because I damn well didn't want to go home. Now, you may be thinking, hey, you know, I'm a big thinker. That's the way I'm going to roll. But it's so easy to return to the mean that I think with every project you do for your boss, as an emerging professional, you should step back and ask yourself what I call the four B's. Could it be bigger? Could it be better? Could it be bolder? And yes, could it be more badass? Because those game-changing ideas so often break the rules. Let me give you just one little example from my own professional life. I started out, after winning Glamour Magazine's Top 10 College Girl Contest, I started out as a young assistant at Glamour and eventually became a young writer, junior writer. And I did little pieces like How to Get Over a Pimple by Saturday Night. You know, really nothing very exciting. And I wanted to write a longer feature, so I went to my boss and I pitched the idea of me doing a major health feature. And my boss said to me, you know, Kate, you don't have any experience researching, so we can't give you that kind of assignment. You don't know how to research. You're not a reporter. You just write those pimple articles. So I thought, oh, I've got to make this happen. To some degree, asking yourself the four B's is a bit like asking the question, what if? And that's what I did when I got back to my desk. I thought, what if I wrote a full-length feature that didn't need any research? So I wrote a feature about the joys and pains of being single. The first essay Glamour would have ever run, I gave it to my boss. She loved it, published it, and from that point on, not only did they have me write a lot of those features, but they gave me my own column as well. One other example, a little bit more exciting. Everybody here know who Kate Spade is? We worked together in the magazine business, and after she started her handbag business, she told me an interesting story. When she came up with her first bags, they were just these very simple black nylon bags, kind of a where fashion meets function. And she was sitting in her living room the night before she went to market with the bags. And she looked at the bags and she thought, darn, there's nothing for the eye to go to. What am I going to do? She got up, went into the bathroom, got a pair of nail scissors, cut out the tag on the inside of the bag that said Kate Spade, New York, and sewed it on the outside. So think about it. That's her huge brand, isn't it? I mean, that's what made Kate Spade that signature look. And in a sense, she asked herself the four B's that night. Could it be bigger, better, bolder, more badass? And she broke the rule that said the tag has got to go on the inside. Now, a couple quick caveats for millennials. Big can't just be about you. So often, when we're young and we start pitching those ideas that we think are going to get us noticed, we make them too much about fulfilling our own needs. They've got to be good for your boss. They've got to create buzz for your company, save your company money, or make your company money. Also, going big too soon can backfire. I don't want to discourage you from stretching, but when I asked Jane Buckingham, one of the top experts on Gen Y, what's the biggest mistake Gen Y make in the workplace? She said sometimes in the desire to leap ahead, we leap ahead so far, leapfrog, that that you end up over your head. So you want to be sure that you're developing the skills that let you go big. Success secret number two, bosses want to be heard. Now, your boss is a major player in your professional life. And yet one of the mistakes I think we make when we're young is that we think too much just about how our boss is responding to us. Does she like me? Does she think I'm doing a good job? When she saw me come in at 9:05 today and she gave me that weird look, was she annoyed because I was coming in late, or was she just having a bad hair day? So we're thinking about how our boss is responding to us. But it's really important to be thinking about how you're going to respond to your boss and really shaping your response to your boss strategically. And one of the key things to know is bosses want to be heard. They want you to know they're listening. You're listening to them. They want you to hear their criticism, which Jessica talked about. It's so important. You have to be careful about not sounding defensive, not sounding prickly, not simply sitting there thinking, oh, she's just a bitch, and really hearing what she has to say and getting that feedback. And they want you to hear their vision. They want to know that you're embracing where they're going. Very important. So, millennial caveat. You must learn how to listen to your boss. And listen between the lines. Even look for her tells or his tells where you get a sense of really what's going on in the mind there. Hear the tough stuff, even if it hurts. Jessica did that. She was willing to hear what her boss had to say. So you're called in to your boss's office for some feedback. If you start to tear up, you can do what Jessica said. You can ask for a little more time, say, look, I'm feeling a little emotional here. Can I come back in an hour? A great trick if you start to tear up is to look up at a light. Stops tears sometimes. Then when you're composed and go back, write it all down and play it back for your boss too. Let's say your boss has told you she doesn't think you're putting enough effort into the PowerPoint presentations you're doing. Play it back to her, but in a positive way. You could say something like, I hear you. I hear you want me to do more research, make the graphics more sophisticated. Let her know that you heard her. And then go back to your desk, digest it, and then send her an email the next day letting her know you heard it. I might have even suggested to Jessica, if she'd wanted to pull that out of the fire, she might have gone back the next day, said to her boss, look, I want a second chance. I know I can do this right. I know I can, I'd like to call the faculty back together. I'd like to represent the proposal myself, and I think I can do it this time. Sometimes there's a way to salvage it. You also need to let her know that you hear her vision. You've got to praise the strategy and results. Now, you may be thinking, that's not my job. I'm a junior player. I don't walk in and congratulate her on what's going on. But bosses love to hear this. Let's say you've just found out that you're going into California. Your company's going into California. Knock on her door, friend. Hey, I just heard we're going into California. Congratulations. Is there anything I can do as part of this plan? It's called sucking up, and it's okay. Bosses want to know that you are buying in to what they're doing, and they do not think that it's silly for you to do that, even if you're only 24 years old. The people who did that for me were always the people I brought along into the inner circle. Last success secret, you must ask for what you want, even if you're sure they know you want it. As women, unfortunately, we so often talk ourselves out of asking because we're afraid they're going to, you know, think we're greedy or needy or entitled, or we tell ourselves, hey, they know I want it. How many of you heard how the Microsoft CEO said lately, women shouldn't ask for raises? Bullshit, right? He said, count on the company, the system to protect you. No, you can't. You must ask for what you want. I figured out how to ask for what I want, what I call my $50,000 moment of truth. I'd gone to be the editor-in-chief of a business magazine for women. I had been promised equity in the company. But I was 7 months pregnant when I got the job. I had also had a kid at home. Life was crazy. I finally realized I'd been here for months and the equity pages haven't arrived. So I nudged. They came. I showed my accountant, Bob, and he said, okay, wow, this plan is so vague, it's almost worthless. I said, well, Bob, tell me what to do then. He goes, okay, you got to go talk to the CEO and tell him he needs to present a clearer equity plan for you. I said, I can do that. He goes, but that's not all. You need to ask for something to make up for the fact that you haven't had, equity for a number of months. I'd say you have to ask for $50,000 in cash. I was like, Bob, this is not The Godfather. This is women's magazines here. And he goes, Kate, if you don't ask, you're a chump. Put on my best power suit, which we wore in the 80s, went in there, said, Dale, plan is too vague. I need something clearer. And he said, fine, Kate, absolutely. I hear you. I said, Dale, but that's not all. I took a deep breath. I don't think I'd ever said the words $50,000 in cash aloud before, but I told him that day. I said, Dale, I'm going to need $50,000 in cash to make up for the months I haven't had equity. And I was sure he was just going to blow me out of the office. But instead, he looks at me like I'm kind of Donald Trump or Barry Diller. And then he goes, all right. And then I'm thinking, why didn't I ask for $75,000, right? But that's the day I realized the squeaky wheel gets the grease. And you have to ask. Ignore that guy from Microsoft. Now, men are 4 to 8 times more likely to negotiate. They negotiate for raises. But the first thing you need to be doing, I would say, think about this now. As you're in the workforce, you're going for your first job, your second job, you need to negotiate for that starting salary. They're almost always lowballing you. You cannot be afraid to ask for more. I'm going to tell you the magic phrase. They say, we're offering you the job, and let's just say they're offering you $50,000. What you say is, I am delighted to get this offer. I would love to work for this company. I would love to work for you. And I think there's something I can really bring that's going to be great here. But I was hoping for X amount. Maybe you go to 60. And then you shut up. You don't say, well, but it doesn't matter. You negotiate for more. And it's just really critical to do that. They are not going to snatch the job away from you if you do. Couple caveats for millennials. Know the right time to ask. When you're first starting out, it's hard to know. You need to know, first of all, when you're asking for a raise, that you have to have something to show for it. A lot of times, my staffers would ask as soon as I gave them a new responsibility. You have to have something to show for it. And in terms of raise time, don't ask at raise time. You need to ask at least 6 to 8 weeks in advance. Go into your boss with a little presentation you're going to make of what your accomplishments, because raises are set in stone often months before. Your boss gets a pool of money and is going to move it around. And it may be too late to go in at raise time. Don't make the ask about you. I once had a girl tell me she needed more money because her husband took a low-paying job in nonprofit. You can't say I've got a gazillion dollars worth of college loans. Your boss doesn't care a rat's ass about your personal life. You have to make the ask about you and the work you're doing. And lastly, discover the value of the pre-ask. It's hard to ask. But a great way to make it easier is to do something I call the pre-ask. The pre-ask is when you sort of butter somebody up. Okay, I'm going to give you an example. Let's say you meet this fabulous woman at the conference today who you realize she's older than you, she works for a company you might love to work for someday, and you want to think of her as someone you can approach at some point. You don't want to just cold call her 6 months from now when you hear there's an opening in the company. So what you do is after the conference, you write to her and you say, gee, it was so great to meet you. We chatted briefly about subject X. Here's a link to an article on subject X I think you would love. Yes, it's a little bit ass kissing too, but trust me, it works. I personally love that kind of stuff. And I shouldn't even have to put this up here, so I'm just going to say it. Say thank you too for anything you get. When I look back at the hundreds of Gen Y women I have helped by offering advice, I probably have received a thank you from about 15%. it's important to thank them, and often with a handwritten note, not just an email, and even a bottle of wine if it's a big give. You need to say thank you. So those are my strategies. Go big, listen, ask, and you'll own the world. And best of luck to all of you. Now, I'm going to bring Jessica back up, and we're going to answer some questions. We have a few minutes to do that in.
That's great.
I think they want you to go up to the mic with a question. And if no one has a question, I'm going to be so unimpressed. You don't know everything at 24, do you?
Be brave. There's no stupid questions.
Hi, my name is Jessica. Great name, by the way. I work in an industry where there's a lot of mandated, you can't ask for raises because it's set. You're in a level that's your zone. But I'm trying to find a way to stand out, maybe by taking additional responsibilities, or looking for new mentoring programs. Like, how do you stand out when, okay, I can't get that raise, but how do I then maybe look for that next promotion, recommendation, like trying to find that way to get that raise since you can't at your current position?
Well, you're in a company that everyone gets the exact same raise?
No, you're based on levels. You come in with your current experience or previous experience, education, and they rate you on a 1, 2, 3 level, and your position has a level, like a set of levels. Then to go to the next promotion, then there's additional, the next up levels, but sometimes there's not always room in your department for that opportunity. So, but you want to, you know, look for ways to maybe ask for mentoring or approaching your boss so that you can get to that next level, even if it's another department, possibly.
Right. Well, then I think it's really critical to look at what it's going to take to get promoted and look at the skill set of the people above you and start to reach out to be doing those kinds of things so that you open yourself up for the opportunity to be promoted. And whenever I promoted anyone at Cosmo, it was always because they were already doing the things that the next level did. Mm-hmm. So just go in there and sort of look at what the people above you are doing. You might even have coffee with a couple of them to get a better understanding of that. And you might even suggest to one of them, gee, if you get busy at some point, I'd love to take some of that off your hands and give it a try. And that could be a backdoor way of doing it. Or you can ask your boss, but you've got to set yourself up by doing those things before they're going to give you a chance to be promoted.
And I would just add that if you have the kind of relationship with your boss where there might be a moment for you to discuss how you imagine the trajectory of your career, you know, maybe it's at performance review, I think it's nice sometimes for supervisors to hear how you're thinking about your career, you know, for you to articulate, you know, I have thoughts about where I'd like to be in 5 years, and here's how I'm strategizing to about how I can add to the company and skills I can gain. So, you know, that your strategy is articulated.
All right, perfect. Thank you very much.
Hi, thank you so much for being here today. I really enjoyed the presentation. My question, I'm curious, there's often, I think, a gender disparity between how we value our own work and contribution. So I'm curious what advice you would have on making sure you're not undervaluing yourself and your work when you make the ask, and then to maybe combating any potential kind of external negative impressions, on being a woman where the perception might be a little bit different and making a hard ask.
Well, the research, Linda Babcock is a professor at Carnegie Mellon, and she is the co-author of Women Don't Ask, and she's kind of a big expert. And what she has learned in, the first bunch of research was just on that women don't ask enough, but she's since learned that there are certain ways you can ask that are better for you as a woman than other ways. And talking about kind of your contribution to the team, smiling. I mean, and you can read her articles on this if you go online to like Linda Babcock and Harvard Business Review. There is a way that in which women, there's more of a conscribed way to ask, I think, than there is for men. What do you think?
Well, one thing I think it's important to understand is men ask for things when studies show that if there's a, on a scale, you need five clear attributes or experiences to go for that additional responsibility promotion. Guys feel they only have to hit two, where women have feel they have to hit all five. So the chances are, if you're already thinking, gee, I'd love to do that, I feel ready, then you are. Guys feel in that way long before you are, because that's the way guys think. And so I think the main thing is just to be sure that as you look for that thing you're asking for, that you do have a certain amount of skill, that you're not going to end up falling on your butt while you're doing it. And, you know, bosses often have a good sense, too, of that whether you'd be able to do it. But they also may not be aware that you're hungry enough for it, that this is what you're craving. And just asking makes your boss see you in a whole new light. My policy was I never gave a promotion to someone who didn't ask for it first. So even if you get shot down, you're going to wake up your boss to thinking, gee, she's more interested in moving up here than I realized.
Thank you. Hi, thank you for the wonderful presentation. I was wondering, when you're working in a team environment where someone else is presenting the work, how do you stand out and show your contribution to your boss?
Well, I think one of the key things, because sometimes, look, you know, we work with all sorts of people in the workplace, and sometimes there are those snakes and barracudas, and they're going to hog it. And I think whenever you're doing with a team, let's say you're all peers, I think it's absolutely valid to say that perhaps it's a joint presentation, that everybody gives a little part of it, or that you take turns or whatever. Don't let a couple of really gutsy guys say, well, why don't I do the presentation? Because sometimes that's what they'll do. If you're contributing to a team where you're a superior makes a presentation, maybe you shoot your boss an email later saying, I thank you for the opportunity to be on that team. I loved it. Something that didn't come up in the presentation that was a little adjunct thing that we discovered that I thought you'd find fascinating is this. You want to make sure you get in there and let your boss know your expertise and what you presented indirectly if you have to.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, things like that's what I was going to say in email. You know, I really love the opportunity to analyze those graphs and, you know, kind of being, you can say it in an appreciative way.
Mm-hmm. One great way to brag about what you're doing at work in a way that so it doesn't sound too much like you're tooting your own horn is to let your boss know other discoveries you made in the process. Mm-hmm. So let's say you were able to get a big sale and your boss knows it and you don't want to keep doing that. But you might say to your boss, there's something that came up during that whole process that I think we could use in another way. And then that shows just the level of your involvement and how deep you dove and how immersed you were in that process.
Me? Hi, thanks for being here. I'm a writer, and I was lucky enough to be able to kind of land a job about a year or so after I graduated from college. And in the couple of years that I've been at my job, I've kind of struggled with this feeling that I've heard others call imposter syndrome, which is like it almost doesn't feel real to me, like I don't deserve to be here. It just kind of like it's a crazy coincidence that I happen to land this job. And so I was kind of wondering if y'all have any advice about just kind of dealing with that sort of anxiety, like especially being like a new professional.
I think so many new professionals feel that. Raise your hand if you've felt that.
Yeah.
Okay. Does that help? I mean, I think that when you're new, you just feel like that. And especially when you're young and new. Mm-hmm. I mean, so I think the fact that you're aware of it is good. Read books. Read feminist books. You know, read books that where people tell you, you know, you might feel part of this is probably because a lot of cues that you have received, like cultural cues that you might not even be aware of, that can be really useful, making those things explicit. Mm-hmm. So, like Joan Williams, What Works for Women at Work is a really good book. Okay.
One thing I would add to that, we've got that negative soundtrack going in our head. My brother told me, just quick story, you know, when he had put on a few pounds, he went to buy a sport jacket. They told him, oh, you've got to go into another department. And he said, guess what they call the department for guys who've put on a few pounds? Executive fit.
Huh.
I thought, that's the way guys think, right? So try to get a mantra that you use that goes to what you know are your core competencies, and you say it. Beyonce, who we shot for covers, you know, she would do that Sasha Fierce thing, and she would do it before the cover shoot, and you just knew she was like, I own the world. I'm Sasha Fierce. Come up with your own Sasha Fierce mantra that you say every day, that you say before you go into a meeting, and I think that really can just wipe away that negative soundtrack.
Channel Beyonce. Listen to Beyonce.
Yeah. That is a great note to end on. And got some feedback here. Sorry,
I'm
gonna turn that down. Sorry about that. So thank you all for being here today, and what amazing speakers and advice that we've had. Please give them a round of applause.